Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Senator Joe Lieberman rejects allowing 55-year-olds to buy into Medicare, and that's not all.
You got to take out the Medicare buy-in. You got to forget about the public option. You probably have to take out the Class Act, which is a whole new entitlement program that will, in future years, put us further in the deficit. And you got to adopt some of the cost containment provisions that will strengthen cost containment that all of us favor.
Senator Joe Lieberman, not a Democrat, not a Republican, the independent from Connecticut, apparently sinking the latest health reform compromise. There on CBS Face the Nation yesterday, Lieberman says letting uninsured Americans 55 and older is as bad or worse than any other public option. He wants to see government subsidies to individuals, but wants the private market to provide the insurance choices. Meanwhile, President Obama meets with leaders of the nation's biggest banks today, as Citigroup is now becoming the last of them to pay back its TARP money. Without taxpayer skin in the game, how will the president convince them to lend more to small businesses and refinance more homeowners facing foreclosure? And will language like this help or hurt?
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
The president on 60 Minutes last night. The Takeaways Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is staying up late with us after his show to keep filling us in on these developments before his midday beauty rest. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Brian. It's still early.
Still early for me. I don't know about for you. Let's talk first about the banks. Is Citigroup really paying back its TARP money?
Allegedly, Citigroup is paying back its TARP money if it can put together this complicated deal with stock swaps and cash and everything else that it needs to do. I'll tell you what, they're in a hurry to do it. They're last to the party to get out from underneath TARP, and you can't pay good bonuses and you can't be a real bank until you pay your money back and get out from under the rules. So they're anxious.
And Citigroup is really in under it. The government gave it $45 billion in loans and agreed to protect losses on nearly $300 billion in risky investment. It just leaves Wells Fargo now as the last national bank that is yet to pay out its bailout money. Citi is going to sell stock, they're said today, to help to repay the government. It has $20 billion left to go because the $25 billion in addition was converted into a 34% ownership stake in the bank earlier this year. Does that mean that the taxpayers own a third of Citibank to this day?
I guess so. I guess that's exactly what it means. I'm not an expert in the financial structure of these firms.
You're
certainly
doing politics.
I am. But there's a lot of politics with these banks, too. And forgive me, I forgot about Wells Fargo. I thought Citigroup was the last one to the finish line here. But, taxpayers own most of AIG, and taxpayers own, I guess about a third of Citigroup. And, President has said he's not in the business of running banks or auto companies for that matter. So I think everyone's anxious to get this thing over and done with.
Right. And I still have some questions about it for our next finance segment. Like, maybe the big Wall Street banks are back to solvency, which is definitely good news. We don't have to worry about the collapse of our financial system anymore, I guess. And people's 401ks and savings accounts and everything else going poof from toxic assets. Politically, does it mean the much maligned TARP program is probably a success?
Well, they may be able to sell it as a success because, we heard last week that a much larger portion of this money will have been repaid than they originally thought when they approved the TARP. When the TARP was first approved, people were prepared, Brian, really to pour, $600 or $500 billion down the hole of Wall Street just to fill the hole. Now it appears that the vast majority of that money will be coming back. A political victory, I don't know. It's hard to formulate a victory on preventing what would have been, proving the negative. Sure, we didn't enter a depression. The true, the worst of the crisis never happened. And if you're the president or the Treasury Department or the Democratic Congress, you may get a little bit of credit for that. But that's a lot less credit than you get for achieving something positive, like a health reform bill or a regulatory overhaul or something like that.
And I'll still want to ask our next financial guest, what happened to all these toxic assets still not off the books? How could so much of that bad debt be unresolved, but the banks get out from under the tarp, which was necessitated by the toxic assets, leaving them broke in the first place.
Right.
So,
it's all very convoluted. I think the president, you know, has maybe a simpler message for the bankers as they go up to the White House to meet with him today. You know, there's a story around Washington, Brian, that's almost apocryphal at this point, that last time they all met, the president told the banking CEOs, "Hey guys, I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks," meaning the populist anger and the torches at the gates calling for the heads of the Wall Street bankers. He might have a similar message today, and he's holding something else over their heads too. He's asking them to lend more. You guys need to lend to small businesses to get the economy going again. We're seeing some positive signs in the economy, but credit is still too tight. There's probably very little the White House can do to force the bank's hand, except for public shame, which you see them exercising now. But also keep in mind the big financial regulatory overhaul bill, the Wall Street regulations, is only halfway done in Congress. It passed the House last week, but it has not passed the Senate. And the president has plenty of levers he can pull in the Senate to make that regulation much stronger or much weaker as he sees fit. So I'm sure he's going to make that known to the CEOs today. I would really like your help because, this bill can be a lot tougher than you want it to be if I feel like you're not cooperating.
So he's got that regulatory hammer to hold over their heads. He wants them to lend more to small businesses. He wants them to resist more foreclosures on homeowners in arrears and also curtail big bonuses. But with respect to the bonuses, why does he stay on that? If the banks are giving back the taxpayers' money, what leverage does the president have anymore, and why should we, the taxpayers, care how they compensate their own people in the private sector?
I don't know how much leverage he has. I think it's good politics. I think it is. I think it's egregious in a populist kind of way. It makes people mad. I think people who don't follow politics in a close way, because they go about their lives doing the things they need to do, I think they understand that. And it angers them. So it makes sense for the president, who wants to be on the side of the public on this one, that it just doesn't make sense for the United States and for the taxpayer to have kept these banks afloat. Meanwhile, they're still walking away with $40 million bonuses. You know, we heard news last week. Okay, it's not all coming in cash. Some of it's in deferred stock. But I think most people feel like $40 million is $40 million any which way you slice it. So it doesn't surprise me that a president wants to get on the populist side of that.
And here's a little bit more of the president on 60 Minutes yesterday, raising that pitchfork and waving it at the bankers.
People on Wall Street still don't get it. They don't get it. They're still puzzled. Why is it that people are mad at the banks? Well, let's see. You know, you guys are drawing down $10, $20 million bonuses after America went through the worst economic year that it's gone through in decades. And you guys caused the problem. And we've got 10% unemployment. Why do you think people might be a little frustrated?
So the president, with tough words on 60 Minutes last night, and a report coming in just now, Todd Zwillick from the website Politico, says at the meeting that's taking place, he's not going to call them fat cats to their face. Isn't that nice? This says Obama will take a measured tone with the bankers, telling them he wants to have a candid and constructive conversation and doesn't want to vilify anyone, according to administration officials. But the president will tell the banks that they have a special responsibility to help spur recovery because of the extraordinary bailout assistance they received last year. So can he be his own good cop and bad cop at the same time? I mean, from a diplomacy standpoint, does he blow them away a little bit and cause defensiveness and reaction by doing what he did on 60 Minutes last night, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, isn't Barack Obama the personification of the measured tone? I mean, everybody knows that.
He wasn't in that clip.
Well, you've seen a lot of people a lot more angry at the banks. It was so remarkable because the president, you know, went just a half step right of measured for the first time. You know, let me put it this way. His pitchfork is not as long and not as sharp as a lot of other people. So I think he knows which way the wind is blowing on this. But whether or not he gets angry in this meeting today or not, I think the message to the bankers is clear, that the White House will do what they can to shame the banks. But will they respond to shame? I don't know. I think they're going to respond a lot more to legislative threats, since they have business before Congress, business that could affect, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue for years to come. This is a major overhaul bill. This is the biggest regulatory crackdown on Wall Street since the Great Depression. So I would think that regardless of which words the president chooses to use with the banking CEOs today, that sort of Damocles over their heads, which is the regulatory bill, is pretty sharp.
We'll get back to Joe Lieberman and health care reform in a minute, but the president isn't the only one who's angry. Scott in Jamaica is angry. Scott, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Brian? Thanks for taking my call.
Good. What you thinking?
Well, this is my issue. One, the idea that this recession or depression is over makes no sense, because I'm in an industry where people are getting laid off all the time and continue to get laid off. So I don't know what circle that I guess the elites travel in, but where I'm from and the type of money that these people are making, they're losing jobs left and right. Secondly, this is a false rally that we're seeing with Wall Street. I mean, if you had money in the stock market last year at this time, maybe, you know, like myself, you're losing money. If you had money at the beginning of this year, all right, you're making some scratch. But this is like a really big false rally. And my other issue, the only issue I have with Obama in terms of this pitchfork, to your speakers, to your guests, just to piggyback what he stated, he has to really attack these guys and definitely enact some type of legislative procedure, because it makes no sense that you're bailing out banks and they're not helping out small businesses or people that need to refinance their homes. How in the world do you take government money and then you have to resort to shame in order to get the banks that you've assisted in the beginning to help people?
So here's what the banks might say to that. They might say, well, Scott, that all sounds like, you know, mom and apple pie and a good patriotic thing to do, but we got into this mess in the first place by giving out too many risky loans. So if the economy is still struggling and we're lending to a lot of small businesses who may not ultimately be able to pay us back, or a lot of homeowners who may ultimately default anyway, then we're going to perpetuate that cycle.
My argument to them would be, all right, I understand that's what got us into this mess. There has to be some type of balance where if someone comes to the bank with a credit score of 680 plus, they shouldn't have to worry about being denied for a small business loan. If someone's in their home and they've been paying on time for 3 to 5 years, you know what? You should be willing to maybe just making this home affordable plan that they had thrown out, which really doesn't take an effect unless you go into foreclosure. You should really help the person that's been paying on time. There should be some type of credit system for people that have been legit.
Scott,
there isn't any credit system. Everybody's thrown into the same batch as those that have defaulted.
Scott, great call. Make your voice heard here again, okay?
Thanks.
Thank you. Now on to Joe Lieberman and health reform. And since it's been a few minutes, let's play that clip again of Joe Lieberman, senator from Connecticut, on 60 Minutes yesterday, saying why he is now not going to be one of the 60 votes that the Democrats need in the Senate to get what we heard as the breakthrough compromise passed.
You got to take out the Medicare buy-in. You got to forget about the public option. You probably have to take out the Class Act, which is a whole new entitlement program that will, in future years, put us further in the deficit. And you got to adopt some of the cost containment provisions that will strengthen cost containment that all of us favor.
So, Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent, what happened here? Didn't Harry Reid tell us last week that he had a deal with 60 senators on this idea of 55 and ups being able to buy into Medicare?
Ooh, he never used the D word. He said broad agreement. He didn't say how broad it was.
And the difference is exactly?
The difference is you need 60 votes, and there are exactly 60 senators in the Democratic caucus. Now, when Harry Reid came out last week and announced a broad agreement on these principles for a construct they were going to send to the CBO with the Medicare buy-in, you know, 55 to 64, with this new kind of private menu of plans that would be private but would be administered by the government as sort of nonprofits as a way to kind of cut costs. When they had those meetings that came to those agreements, keep in mind, Joe Lieberman was not one of the 10 senators in the room. Originally, this was a group of 11, and Lieberman stayed away, not because he didn't necessarily support what they were doing, but he knew that he was on the fence, and he didn't think that his presence there would be terribly constructive. Turns out he was probably right. They might not have been able to get even this far with Lieberman in the room. So I don't think a lot of us are surprised that Lieberman is now doing this. And I don't think it necessarily scuttles the whole bill. There's a lot of what they call moving parts on this. They'll take Lieberman's comments. They'll go back to him. Could you support a narrower buy-in? Could you support this, Joe? Could you support that? And if the answer is no, if the bridge is not bridgeable, if the chasm is not bridgeable here between what Joe Lieberman can say yes to and what the Democrats can sell to their base as a public option or strong, real health reform, then you forget about Joe Lieberman, and this becomes about shopping for a Republican vote. It becomes about Olympia Snow or Susan Collins, more likely Snow. Olympia Snow is increasingly frustrated with Harry Reid's attempt to get this bill passed by Christmas. She's saying so. She said so over the weekend.
But she's not for the public option either.
She's not for the public option either, but as it's starting to be less about what is a public option and what can they call a public option, or if it's not just in a name, what can they sell that achieves the same thing as a public option? Broader access with cost cutting that doesn't break the bank for the taxpayer. So I think that the actual term public option is something that senators feel the public has gotten hung up on because of the senator's sales job, really. That's the reason why. And the president's sales job on it, they have only themselves to blame. And it's an impediment now.
And here, I think, is a caller supporting Senator Lieberman, Kenneth in Washington Heights. Hi, Kenneth. Thanks for calling.
Yes, well, I would like to point out that the insurance business is one of Connecticut's major industries. And I'm not for Senator Lieberman. I think he's afraid that allowing people to buy into Medicare would undercut these businesses in price, and it might hurt their businesses.
Aha, so this is a political analysis from Kenneth, really, Todd, that's saying as the senator from Connecticut, he is the senator from the Hartford and, you know, the other insurance
right.
companies located there with their headquarters. You think that's an accurate take?
Certainly, it's got to be a consideration because senators represent their constituents both in the business community and in the public. The question, believe me, has been asked of Senator Lieberman many, many times. It's obvious he's from Connecticut, and it's obvious that Connecticut is the traditional home of the insurance industry. He acknowledges that connection but says that this has absolutely nothing to do with it. Of course, he points out that he is opposed or he has supported legislation in the past that the industry desperately did not want. So he points to those things. None of us is inside of Joe Lieberman's head right now to know exactly what he's thinking, but those are all things to consider.
So last thing, and we know that Senator Ben Nelson is still insisting on very restrictive abortion rules in this bill. Do you think the majority of Democrats will go for a bill that would bring either Lieberman and Nelson or Snow and Nelson or Snow and Lieberman on board, because that seems to be the math of it? So that would mean, you know, maybe new regulation on insurance companies, lots of subsidies to buy in, a requirement for businesses to cover people or pay, get covered but no public get covered if you're an individual who's uninsured, but no public option, no long-term care insurance. That's the CLASS Act that Senator Lieberman referred to. Tighter controls on abortion, and the Democrats would say, okay, maybe we'll come back at a later date and try to improve it from their point of view, or will too many more liberal Democrats walk away?
That may be the calculus that you just described may be exactly what the Democratic leadership is banking on, and I think Harry Reid probably feels a little bit differently about this than Nancy Pelosi does. She's more liberal than he is, but she presides over a House where the Democratic caucus is far more liberal than it is in the Senate. And it seems to be that the leaders in Congress are banking on the fact now that as they edge more and more towards the middle, as they edge more towards the Liebermans and the Nelsons to get the bare minimum of votes that they need, they seem to be relying on the fact that liberals in the Democratic caucus will want to pass something, that in the end they'll swallow a bitter pill even if it's not what they want and say, this is the best we can get, we don't like it, but if we don't pass health care, it really damages the Democratic brand. You know, a lot of them are walking around Congress, Brian, saying if we don't pass this and it's not substantial, voters will legitimately ask themselves, why the heck did we vote the Democrats in the first place? And in 2010, those Democrats who, those core base Democrats who strongly support the public option and strongly support Obama and health reform, they'll just stay home. And the Republicans are going to be fired up. So I think the Democrats really feel the need to deliver something and then do the best job they can to sell it. I don't know exactly what that's going to be yet, but it seems like some of the liberals may be getting pushed up against a wall here, and it's not the first time this year.
Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Todd, thanks a lot.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, New York State finds physical abuse and untreated mental illness in its juvenile prisons. This is a horrible story. It led the New York Times today, and we will talk to the state's youth division chief, Gladys Carrion, and Jeremy Travis from John Jay, who chaired the task force looking into these horrible things. Stay with us.